You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
Hi, and welcome to this week's Corner House podcast. I'm back. I'm Sarah Perks, a Programme and Engagement Director here at Corner House. Thank you, Bren, for covering. This week, we're going to review the new release, The Guard, the Irish comedy starring Don Cheadle and Brendan Gleeson. We're also going to speak to Simon Chin, who's the producer of the moving documentary that's just come out called Project NIM. Also going to tell you a bit more about our Edition 3 exhibition that opens this weekend. And of course, one of the Corner House team will give us their recommendation of the week. Okay, let's start off with our film focus. This week's film is The Guard, and I am, of course, joined by our regular contributor, Mr. Andy Willis, from the University of Salford. Okay, so this film, it's the directorial debut from John Michael McDonagh. Who is he, Andy?
In all the lead-up to this film, everyone has quoted the fact that he's Martin McDonagh's brother. People will know Martin McDonagh. He's a very, very successful stage playwright, but probably most well-known for writing and directing In Bruges, which was quite a big hit, I think, 2008?
I saw this film back in February, and I think I mentioned it on the podcast then as I saw it at the Berlin Film Festival. Really, really enjoyed it. But of course, Andy's seen it more recently, so he could do a quick synopsis for us.
As ever, it's one of those films where it kind of is so character-driven. The synopsis is fairly unimportant. Basically, we have a murder on the west of Ireland in Galway, and a Garda investigating that murder, and then that becomes involved with a big plot to smuggle drugs into Ireland, and an FBI agent is sent over to coordinate trying to stop the drugs being imported. So that's the plot, but really it's a character piece driven, I think, as you said, Don Cheadle's in it. Don Cheadle brings that kind of Hollywood glamour, but really the film is driven by a really powerhouse performance, I think, by Brendan Gleeson, who was in Bruges with Colin Farrell, so he clearly is someone that the McDonaghs can work with quite well. And he plays Jerry Boyle, who's a very, very unconventional policeman, doing many of the things you would expect policemen to be stopping people from doing, but he takes great pleasure in actually doing them. And that's kind of what makes him such a likeable character. I think what drives this film very much is the kind of likeability of Brendan Gleeson, both as an actor and then the way that this character is written, amongst a lot of other fairly unlikable policemen or kind of naive policemen around him. I really liked it. I thought it's a really, really nice, sort of light, yet also on occasion quite violent, but not, you know, comic book violence, really, I think, not sort of horrible violence, but quite a funny and amusing film. How did you find it?
Yeah, it's sort of like a bit of a black comedy, but it's quite gentle, even though it deals with serious things. And I quite liked the sort of, it plays a little bit on the like buddy cop film, or you know, like putting, you know, you always get two cops put together who are opposites and how they deal with that. I'm sure Andy probably got some examples of previous buddy cop.
The one oddly that it reminded me of the most, although the film isn't actually like the film, and I think it's kind of a more comedic version of In the Heat of the Night, you know, with Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger. And again, the same kind of local blustery copper and the big city guy who comes in. The film isn't like In the Heat of the Night, but their relationship, I think, is kind of riffing off that kind of black and white cop together.
Yeah, like Beverly Hills Cop.
Well, maybe like Beverly Hills Cop, yeah.
I definitely agree this is Brendan Gleeson's film. He is, you know, pretty much in the film all the time, and he's really, really strong performance. What have I seen him in before, Andy?
Well, in Bruges, obviously, but he's in things like Gangs of New York. He's in a lot of American films of that sort. You know, he's quite a heavyweight actor. He didn't start acting till later. Well, he was an actor, but he didn't start professionally acting, I think, till he was into his mid-30s. So I think he's someone who's kind of arrived almost fully formed as a mature performer. So he's had lots of those character roles. We never saw him as a young man. There's no sort of footage of Brendan Gleeson, in the background on a TV drama or anything like that. He kind of appeared fully formed as a mature actor. And I think that's helped him a lot, really. And he's got quite a gravitas, I think, in this film. It seems on the surface to be just a kind of knockabout humorous performance, but I think it's very nuanced. One of the key things I thought in the film that made that work so well was the relationship between him and his mother. Again, I won't say too much about what happens, I don't want to spoil it, but I think that relationship gave the character depth and moved the film on from just being a kind of knockabout, mixed-matched police pairing sort of drama. And the mother is played by Fionnuala Flanagan, who people will recognise. She's an actress you will have seen a lot. She plays the housekeeper in The Others a few years ago. And of course, whenever I see her, she always reminds me of any episode of Murder, She Wrote set on the Emerald Isle, because she's always one of Hollywood's great TV Irish people. So she's on, you'll recognise her from loads of TV dramas.
An island, or the Emerald Isle itself, is sort of a character as well. It's set on the west coast around Galway and in the countryside around there. But it's quite a murky character, isn't it? You know, the weather's not great. I know that's probably quite true of the west coast. But how do you feel? Was it important that it's set in Ireland?
I think, you know, alongside Brendan Gleeson's character, this setting is very important that it is on the other side of Ireland. And there's lots of jokes about people from Dublin, the attitude of Dublin to the rest of Ireland and all of those sorts of things. And of course, what Brendan Gleeson's character does slowly but surely as the film progresses is he undermines that kind of country bumpkin character that often comes from that sort of area. So yes, I think the setting is really, really important.
Yeah, we're recommending it. It's a good end of summer, you know. It's good to see a comedy. It's good to see something set in Ireland. It's got amazing lead actors. So, I recommend it. I think people should go and check it out this weekend. And it is screening, of course, here from Friday the 19th of August. And the trailer and the times are all to be found on our website.
Art, film, books, food, drink. All at Cornerhouse, Manchester.
Now it's time to have a look at what's going on this week. Okay, first up, we've got a new exhibition opening in Gallery 1. It's part of our edition series, and this one's called the Hafsa Naib Video Systems. And it's a month-long exhibition that started when Hafsa decided to put an advert out which asked people, have you got an idea for a tiny film? And then the artist has been working here over the summer to make a series of three collaborative films. So you should come and find out the results of that. And particularly, it's got quite an innovative way of presenting it. I think it's better if you come and experience it rather than just take my word for it. And also, if you want to find out a little bit more, Hafsa will be here to do a tour and talk about the process behind the work on Saturday. So the preview event is 6 p.m. till 8 p.m. on Friday the 19th of August, and you're all invited. And the tour where Hafsa is going to talk about the work in more detail is 2 p.m. till 3 p.m. on Saturday the 20th of August. So I will see you there. Alongside The Guard this week, we've got another release in the cinema from Friday. It's called In a Better World. Now, I haven't seen it, but this is very famous because it won the Best Foreign Language Oscar this year at the Oscars. Andy, do you know anything about this film?
I've not seen it either, but I am really looking forward to it. As you say, if it was in a field for the Oscar that included things that we've already seen at Cornerhouse over the last sort of year or so, Beautiful, Dogtooth, Incendies, Outside the Law, all films that we kind of liked and on the podcast have been very positive about. If this was able to beat those to the Oscar, then it's definitely going to be worth seeing. Plus, the director, Suzanne Beer, she made the original Brothers, which was remade in Hollywood recently by Jim Sheridan and which has been playing over the last few months. And she also made a film with Halle Berry and Benicio del Toro, Things We Lost in the Fire, which I don't think did that well at the box office, but I think did glean some very positive reviews. So all in all, as well as winning the Oscar, it also won the Golden Globe for Best Foreign Language Film. So it's got a weight of critical acclaim behind it, so I'm really looking forward to it. It sounds like a film that's kind of based around a sort of moral compass. It starts off, I think, a doctor who has a very nice and comfortable life in Denmark, but also then works in the Sudan in a refugee camp. And he has to make a series of moral decisions in that refugee camp, which then, when he goes back to Denmark, are paralleled with decisions he has to make about his own family. It does sound really, really good. The performances have all been acclaimed in everything that I've read about it. So having seen The Guard, this is what I'll be coming to next week, I think.
It's always worth remembering that the Best Foreign Language Oscar shortlist are always really quite accessible films. So they tend to be quite popular films. Of course, they're just in another language. So I do think it will be one that will have a real, you know, really good general appeal to it. Okay, thank you for that, Andy. Also on this weekend, outside of Corner House, I'm sure the weather will be great, so you can go along to Manchester's only outdoor arts festival this weekend. It's called Platform 4. It's 2 days, 2 nights of free events for all the family. Friday, Saturday night, you've got to head down, not to any platforms, but to Castlefield Arena to catch some circus skills and aerial spectacles. And then on Saturday and Sunday, you can catch street theatre, dance, comedy, and much more in Piccadilly Gardens, St Anne's Square, and also New Cathedral Street. So that's Platform 4, the number 4 festival, from this Friday, the 19th of August, to Sunday, the 21st of August. If you want to find out some more details, visit their website at www.xtracks, xtrax.org.uk/platform4.
You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
Now, one of the films on our screens this week is Project Nim, and hopefully some of you attended the Q&A with myself and producer Simon Chim last Friday evening. It's a story of a chimpanzee called Nim, who was raised as a human child in the 70s in America as part of a scientific experiment to find out if animals could learn sign language. So the documentary is brought to us by Oscar-winning director and producer James March and Simon Chin, who's the team behind Man on Wire, which I know most of you will have seen, and of course won the Oscar for Best Documentary. It's a really like thought-provoking piece, raises a lot of questions around how we use animals in scientific research, but also it's a sort of story about about Nim himself, about a character. It's an extremely well-told story. And last week, we were lucky enough to welcome the producer, Simon Chin, to the Q&A I mentioned before. And our programme and communications assistant, Ella, caught up with Simon beforehand and asked him how he came across this story.
James Marshall, the director, and I had made a film called Man on Wire together. And it was after Man on Wire, James and I were sort of rooting around for the next one. The bar felt quite high. It was such an amazing story. And I felt we had to find an equally amazing story. So we were throwing ideas back and forth, and none of them are quite sticking. Until one morning, actually, I came down for breakfast, and my dear wife, Lara, who was actually 6 months pregnant at the time, was sort of crying her eyes out reading this article about Nim's story. And that was really my kind of entry point. It sort of struck me immediately. I read the story, and what kind of struck me about it was how poignant it was, and also how much it felt like a story for, kind of allegory for kind of parents and parenting. And it really is a story about how we discharge our responsibilities in society to those who are more vulnerable than us, you know, be they chimps or children, you know.
Just for anyone who doesn't yet know about the experiment, and without kind of spoiling the film, can you tell us a little bit about what Nim the chimpanzee is involved in?
Very simply, Project Nim was a scientific experiment in the 70s, a fairly radical one, that was the brainchild of a very learned professor, Herbert Terrace, from Columbia University, who wanted to disprove Chomsky's big idea that language was uniquely human. So his idea was to take a chimp away from its mother at birth and to give it to a human family to bring up this chimp from infancy as a human, to clothe it, to, you know, give it pizza, to, you know, to do everything possible to socialize it as a human. And the idea was, as a byproduct of that, that it would acquire language, in this case sign language, like us, and that would be able to construct sentences. The bigger ambition was that we would be able to understand what the chimpanzee was thinking. So it was a very big and ambitious idea. I mean, actually, had it succeeded, you know, it would have actually redefined what it was to be human. And that was the aim. I mean, unfortunately, things didn't quite go according to plan. Everyone had different agendas and different ideas. You know, Nim's mother really had no interest in the science. So there were lots of squabbling. And in the middle of all this was poor Nim. Nim's life, there are ups and downs, and there are low points, but the film is poignant. You know, there are a lot of amazing characters in the story, human characters who form these incredibly touching and profound relationships with this chimpanzee. And that, for me, was one of the great revelations of working on the film, that actually chimpanzees are capable of forming these bonds with humans, which are different from the kind of bonds you form with a cat or a dog. Chimps are extraordinary, and I hope that this film kind of shows that.
What was your starting point for making the film? How did you begin to put it together?
Well, the starting point was really a book. The article my wife was reading was based on a book by Elizabeth Hess. Elizabeth had spent some years writing and researching this book, and her idea was to do a biography of an animal. And that's really how her story is told. That was sort of James and my sort of initial thought, was wouldn't it be great to do a biography of an animal that kind of felt like something we hadn't seen before? So I contacted Elizabeth. She was thankfully a fan of Man on Wire. Quickly, she seemed very keen to work with us, quickly optioned the book. She'd also done a lot of the groundwork in terms of building the relationships with many of the people who had brought Nim up, principally his first mother, Stephanie. And there are other mothers throughout the course of his life. But certainly kind of through Elizabeth, we were able to establish contact with and kind of sort of secure the kind of willingness, I guess, of many of the principal characters, and there were others who we had to approach quite independently. But Elizabeth, I guess, and her book was the starting point for us.
Was it difficult to get hold of the archive footage for the film? I know that the film's quite heavily reliant on that.
Well, we had a very good archive producer who's based in New York, who we kind of signed up very early on, and that's really one of the first things that we always tend to do on these docs, because the archive so much kind of informs the kind of the approach to the film, the style. So she started working away, and we amassing material, and we had a sense that that would be a lot, but certainly she found some things that we were very, very happy to find. We weren't expecting to find. There is a scene, for example, when Nim is introduced to another chimpanzee for the first time in his life, aged about 4. Or 5, and you know, it's an extremely sort of profound moment. This is a chimpanzee who essentially thinks that he's a human, and this is a moment where he's suddenly confronted by the fact that he's not a human. And without wishing to project or anthropomorphize, it feels like a moment of kind of great bewilderment and confusion for him. And there were other archive finds, but we were very happy with the amount of archive there was out there, and I always felt that there would be a lot.
I suppose going back to that point you mentioned about the moment in the footage where Nim realises that he's not a human, I think that probably brings up one of the things that quite a few people will be quite concerned with in the film, and that's, I suppose, the moral issue of, did the people who were raising Nim at the time, you know, did they ever question the kind of moral dilemma of their relationship with the animal? And I kind of wondered, was it difficult for you to draw that out of the people you interviewed?
I suppose we never approach the film from a kind of particularly moralising perspective. I mean, our ambition with this was merely to tell the story in the best way possible. And if a kind of morality emerges in the film, it's not a morality that we've kind of spoon-fed. Certainly a lot of the characters, I mean, this was an experiment that started in the 70s where, and you have to kind of, I think, look at it in that context. I mean, you know, perhaps people didn't know as much about chimpanzees as they do now. Certainly the ethics of social experiments with animals have changed. It was very much in vogue in the 70s. So some of the things that people describe, some of the events from our kind of period of hindsight, feel utterly sort of shocking and preposterous. I mean, Stephanie Nim's first mother talks about breastfeeding him. Someone else talks about how Stephanie was interested in Nim's masturbation, which seems like it often gets quite a big laugh in the film, partly because it's so shocking. I mean, I think we laugh rather knowingly at that moment. But I suppose the point is that a lot of the people wanted to confront these issues because they feel a great sense of remorse about them. And I think that does come across very strongly in the film. There is a lot of guilt for a lot of these people in what ended up happening to Nim.
You're probably aware that there are a couple of chimp movies out this week, not least Rise of Planet of the Apes. We wondered whether or not this was a conscious decision, do you know, on behalf of the distributors?
I would say it was sort of semi-conscious. I mean, you know, I think we were always aware that that film was sort of in the process of being made and was going to come out at this time. I mean, beyond that, the timing was, I think, fairly fortuitous. I think it's a very good thing. I mean, I haven't seen Rise of the Planet of the Apes, but I understand there's a lot of crossover. I was reading an interview with the writers of that film this morning, which they were talking about having studied Nim for that film. I mean, I believe there's a section of the film where a chimp is home-reared, is taught sign language. You know, so I think they were very conscious of all of that. Of course, the Planet of the Apes franchise itself sort of came about in the late 60s and 70s, very much the time in which the Nim story started. And I think just generally in America at that time, there was a sort of vogue for looking at chimps and sort of comparing them to ourselves very directly. I think we've since learned, perhaps, and I hope maybe this is one of the messages of the films, that as much as, you know, we overlap very significantly with chimps, and they're a lot like us, that they are also very distinct from us, and we shouldn't mess with them too much. We should really leave them to their own kind.
Lastly, I was wondering, other than Project Nim, do you have another favourite chimp or monkey film which you'd like to tell us about?
I mean, I watched a few chimp docs in preparation of this. I mean, Babette Schroeder made a very good film about Coco the gorilla, And Fred Wiseman made a film called Primate about the Yerkes Primate Institute. I mean, I would say they were probably my favourite films. I think films about chimps or monkeys. I mean, as a kid, I watched Every Which Way But Loose, but I'm not sure that necessarily figures in my top 10.
So that's Project NIMH. It's in its second week of screening. Do come along and watch it if you get the chance. Don't go and see the Planet of the Apes thing. Come and see Project NIMH instead. All times are on our website, and if you buy tickets online, there's no extra booking fee.
Art, film, books, food, drink. All at Corner House, Manchester.
Okay, before we go, we've just got time for our staff recommendation of the week. So our visual arts programme manager and also been hosting the podcast recently, Bren O'Callaghan, steps in with a little foodie recommendation.
My recommendation this week is a really small restaurant that's called Seoul Kimchi. And I'd heard about this restaurant for a good few years and people were raving about it and I thought it couldn't possibly live up to the hype. And I thought, no, it's finally time to go and check this place out. It's just a short walk from the Curry Mile in Rochambeau behind the hospital complex on Upper Brook Street. As I say, it's called Seoul Kimchi and it's absolutely tiny. It's a Korean restaurant. I have no idea about Korean food at all. Chinese food, perhaps. Japanese food, didn't know what to expect. It has only three tables. It's quite cleverly laid out because they have mirrors on the wall to make it look bigger than it actually is. But you can they can only seat three groups of maybe two or three people at a time. And people do go in and out for takeaways. But it was absolutely fantastic. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. I couldn't tell you what we ordered. We just chose a set menu from the Korean section and the food just kept coming. We had lots of small plates of seaweed and noodles and tiny little fish that looked like they'd been scooped out of an aquarium but were very tasty. Then this kind of beef sizzler arrived, and no sooner had we finished the beef sizzler than the actual owner of the restaurant ran out with some extra beef that she'd cooked and said, "Would you like this too? Yes, please." And it was all came to about £30 for two people. With soft drinks, and we couldn't finish all the food that was laid out for us. So it's more of a kind of canteen style, so don't expect a formal restaurant, and the kitchen is actually open in the main area itself, but I definitely recommend it. Seoul Kimchi, Upper Brook Street in Manchester.
So thanks for that, Bren, and thank you for covering me again next week. That's everything for today. Next week, we're going to have a Spanish special for you with the opening of Pedro Almodóvar's much-anticipated The Skin I Live In. For more information on everything we've talked about this week, do check our website, www.cornerhouse.org. Alternatively, follow us on Twitter at CornerhouseMCR or become a fan on Facebook. And don't forget, you can now get all these podcasts on iTunes, so there's no excuse. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to the Corner House podcast.